Okay, any preliminary questions or issues? Questions about the exam? I assume everybody's had a chance to pick it up from Sue. She's there. She was just there. She was handing, I'm sure several of you got your exams just in the last 5 minutes, so. Okay, well, I hope the email was explanatory. What's that? Oh, yeah. Yes, we're still working through that one, so. We finished yesterday with the wrongful death section, except for the little reference to the end of the chapter, and not everybody has I'm not clear on whether everybody has the last pages of chapter 3. What all do you have as the last? Show me the end of chapter 3 if you've got it there. Yeah, okay, good. So there are a couple of last pages that deal with a statutory revision in California, and I wanted to say something about the way that came about. You may recall the case of there was a woman who was killed by a dog. I forget what kind, a Rottweiler or some kind of a dog in San Francisco. She had a domestic partner who wanted to recover from the owners of the dog for wrongful death. And criminal trial against the owners of the dog was fairly well publicized. I think it was on Court TV or otherwise covered by the media. And eventually the owners of the dog were convicted, I believe, of manslaughter, something like that. In any event, she had filed a civil claim against the owners of the dog, claiming that they were liable for the wrongful death of her partner. At the time she filed the claim, the California statute said that essentially the people entitled to recover for wrongful death are the spouse, the children, et cetera, et cetera. And she in filing the lawsuit, said, in effect, I am the equivalent of a spouse, and for the statute to permit a heterosexual couple to, or the heterosexual spouse of a decedent to recover, but not a homosexual partner of a decedent, that's discriminatory. It's unconstitutional. And as I recall, the trial judge who got the motion from the defendant files a motion saying, you don't qualify under the statute. And the plaintiff said, oh, yes, I do, because to interpret it any other way would be unconstitutional. I believe the trial judge accepted the plaintiff's argument of unconstitutionality and refused to dismiss the claim. And, of course, the defendant filed an appeal planning to challenge the trial court's finding that the statute unconstitutionally discriminated. But in the meantime, while that appeal was pending, the California legislature adopted this statute that's reproduced for you here on page 120, providing that domestic partners would qualify for wrongful death claims. Now, one of the reasons that I bring this up is to illustrate the way in which the statutory definitions of who is entitled to recover are subject to, significant dispute. Exactly who should qualify for a wrongful death recovery. There's nothing written in stone anywhere that says these people are the logical, natural beneficiaries. In many ways, it's a reflection of public policy. Again, as obviously this raises a lot of controversial issues about which I'm sure we could have a very interesting discussion, and we'll have more interesting discussions later on today, but my purpose for the moment is simply to illustrate the fact that if you represented either the plaintiff in that case or the defendant in that case, the ability of the plaintiff to recover or the liability of what the defendant would have to pay might depend very much on this, you know, controversial, the resolution of this controversial issue. So, again, sometimes your work is very clearly laid out for you. Here are the rules. Here's the way the rules are interpreted. Here's how they're enforced. Sometimes the rules are put up for grabs. And so, again, it's one of the challenging things about representing a client in a situation like that. How do you advise somebody in a way that takes account of both the state of the law as it is and the state of the law as it might be by the time you're finished with this particular issue? So one way to sort of formulate the question, and again would launch us into an interesting discussion, would be if you were a member of the California legislature and there were essentially an assignment that everybody in the legislature said what we need is to start on a blank sheet of paper, no preconceptions about this, just start with a blank sheet of paper, and you describe, you know, write a new statute providing a remedy in the event of wrongful death. Who's entitled to recover? What should they be able to recover? And again, something we'll talk about later in this chapter when we come to the so-called bystander or loss of consortium claims, the same problem will reemerge when we're talking not about the death of a person, but a very significant disability of a person. For example, in the Rodriguez case, where a 600-pound pipe drops on Mr. Rodriguez, and Mrs. Rodriguez said, hey, you, in effect, dropped that 600-pound pipe on our marriage. I need a recovery of my own in addition to whatever my husband Richard is entitled to. And once you start thinking about, okay, what about the related parties? Which related parties get a place at the cashier's window to ask for compensation? What is the dividing line that says, okay, these people get to ask the jury for compensation, but this group of people do not? What's our criterion? And again, as in the case of wrongful death, you could err on the side of being overly generous. We're down to the first cousins once removed and the, you know, people on the drill team in seventh grade that still keep in touch by email. Well, no, I think at some point we're going to say no. On the other hand, you could err on the side of being stingy. That is, people whom everybody would recognize suffered intensely because of the loss of this person, either as in this case by death or by some other catastrophic injury. On what basis do you say to such a person, no, I'm sorry, you didn't suffer a loss compensable, recognizable at law? So again, this difficulty, part of it is that you encounter cases, statutes written at a time when people had different ideas than perhaps you now have. But the other difficulty is, even if I didn't have that to worry about, I was drawing on a blank sheet of paper, I could make up whatever rule I wanted, how could I come up with a rule that was both fair, enforceable, consistent, etc. Not an easy task by any means. And again, one of the reasons that I point this out is to say that when judges confront statutes or interpretations of statutes that are less than perfect, judges may be inured to that from the fact that, well, no statute is perfect. It's not like we could replace this imperfect statute with a perfect one. There's no statute that's going to make everybody happy. Ms. Schmidt? Yeah. There may be such a trend. I don't know of one if there is. Again, what states tend to do is not so much say, we're a Survival Act state or we're a wrongful death state. By the way, today is Washington's, I noticed on the, today is Washington's, whatever it is, 122nd birthday, whatever it was in 1889, Washington became a state on this day. Okay. It's not as though the states identify themselves with one of these. You tend more to have a kind of mix and match. They'll pick a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Well, we like this part of it, but we're going to draw on something over there as well. It's one of the reasons why when you pick up the statute on the exam, instead of saying, oh, this is a Survival Act, I know how this is going to work, you have to read it to say, well, it appears they've started off on this tack, but I've got to read through the rest of it to figure out what they've done with it. Now, again, the reason that it's kind of helpful to divide it into one concept or the other is that other things tend to follow from that. That is, if your focus is on the survivors, if it's a wrongful death kind of statute, then you're more interested in their losses, both economically and non-economically. You may, as this is, for example, what Washington does, just as an example, not to suggest that's anything more than just an example, but in Washington, they have essentially a wrongful death statute, but in addition, they say the decedent's pain and suffering prior to death is compensable. So that's added on to a wrongful death recovery. But again, we don't measure the loss of the decedent's capacity to enjoy life. That's what the Connecticut statute did and is consistent in that respect. It's Nancy Feldman's loss of income, Nancy Feldman's loss of the capacity to enjoy life, whereas the Washington statute mixes and matches by saying it's the loss to the spouse, to the children, if there are none, you know. There's actually a special statute in Washington that allows parents to recover for the loss of society and companionship of their children, either by death or by injury. So it's very generous in that respect. I don't, as a parent, I don't have to go through any of the stuff that's later on in the chapter about proving that this is the kind of case that qualifies. The statute says if the relationship with my child has been injured by somebody else's negligence, I get to recover for that. The statute says I can. I'm given a number to line up at the cashier's window and state my claim. But otherwise, again, the wrongful death statute says it's the loss of the spouse, the children, the relatives, in effect, plus the decedent's pain and suffering prior to death. If it's a Kenneth Rice airplane crash, there really isn't much. Although my friend Dick Iman, who was one of our alums, past president of the State Bar Association, personal injury lawyer, Dick Iman had a case where he represented the families of the crew on the HART flight it's a helicopter rescue, you know, emergency thing, and something went wrong with the tail rotor on this helicopter, and it crashed. And he spent a long time describing to the jury and asking them to compensate the last, whatever it was, 73 seconds of their life, from the time they realized the helicopter was going down until it hit the ground and exploded or whatever. 73 seconds. How much pain and suffering could you go through in those 73 seconds? Well, he thought quite a bit, and so did the jury. Now, so again, the way in which these things are first set up, what is the measure of damage? Who gets to recover? What do they get to recover? And then, again, the capacity of the advocate to persuade the jury, here's how much this is worth. Just as another kind of war story here, I was involved in a case where the firm where I was working represented a girl who went out to the Air Force Base. Her father was in the service or something, I forget what the deal was. In any event, she's out there, it's on a January day, there's snow on the ground, there's this puddle of water that's kind of little sort of vapor coming off the water. She goes to stick her foot in this puddle of water. Turns out it's the leak from a steam tunnel, and the water is about 180 degrees. She sticks her boot into this thing. The boot immediately is encased in 180 degree water. She suffers very significant burns up to about about 8 inches up her leg. Well, the parents not only wanted her to recover for the burn injury and the pain and suffering and so forth and so on, but the parents wanted a recovery under this Washington statute for their pain and the injury to the relationship to their child. How do you characterize how has a burn injury to my child affected my relationship to my child? How do you value that? So again, this is one of the things we confront throughout the chapter. How do you gauge the compensation in such a way that you provide a reasonably consistent measure of compensation so that injuries are treated in a relatively comparable way? People who suffer a broken arm get this level of compensation. People who suffer a spinal cord injury get this kind of compensation. People who are killed get this kind of compensation, and so forth. Not an easy task, again, and no one would claim that you can lay out the awards and say, oh, yes, this follows a logical progression. Some are really high, some seem really low, but again, we trust juries to make their best judgment about what's fair. Yeah. No, not really. For purposes of the law, as callous as this might seem, animals are treated as property. So if you run over my dog, or you do something else that causes injury to an animal with whom I have a close relationship, the law essentially says that's no different than if I ran over your car or I caused a fire that burned a favorite painting of yours or some other object for which you had great... to which you ascribe great value, but it's a piece of property. There have been people that say, in effect, no, it's closer to, you know, what did Harry Truman say? If you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. You know, you're you're much more likely to find loyalty from a dog than you are from the people that you're going to meet in that town. So Harry Truman felt after a while. But the law says, in effect, sorry, that doesn't count. Again, you could change that by legislation. You could say there will be a cause of action for loss of companionship with my animal companion. Please don't call it a pet. But again, that's a matter of public policy. Do we want to create a cause of action or a measure of damages for that? The law thus far has said no. I wouldn't quite go there. I think the problem that you're going to find in the domestic partner situation is, what's the difference between a legally sanctioned marital relationship and a different kind of relationship among human beings that is intense, and so forth and so on? The critics of the domestic partnership movement, the effort to get domestic partnership recognized as a sort of equivalent of marriage, there are two basic criticisms. The people who would vote against this kind of legislation, number one is the sense that it undermines marriage. So to the extent that people think, gee, marriage, you know, the federal marriage amendment supporters would say marriage is something unique, important, clearly defined. It doesn't have any equivalent. And it has to be sort of like a trademark or a brand name that you have to protect from dilution, as they say in the trademark business. The other criticism is, what is it about domestic partnership that qualifies it rather than some equally intense relationship? Suppose this being Veterans Day, there is a guy who was saved in a war situation by his army buddy who crawled, you know, through some machine gun nest to pull him back to safety and saved his life. And then this buddy was later seriously injured. And one guy says, for the rest of my life, I'm going to take care of him. We don't have sex, but we have a very intense, this is my brother here. Why would that not qualify? Should that qualify? It's not, those people aren't domestic partners. They wouldn't qualify for wrongful death. Why should people, just because they have sex, qualify? And again, it raises the whole issue of, you know, what do you think about heterosexuality, homosexuality? What should society's attitude be? Recognition, approval, marriage, criminal punishment, all of these things are very much up for grabs in terms of how the society views the proper public policy. So again, I didn't quite want to wade into that. We have yet more ground to cover that's far from easy. But let me just say, for purposes of your technical training here as a torts lawyer, just to recognize that you're kind of in a minefield here, in which the disagreement within the society produces uncertainty in the body of law. We don't know who would qualify for recovery, who wouldn't. We don't know it, you know, by the time we get done with this in 3 or 4 years, what the state of the law will be. Similarly, the old law used to be that, for example, an engaged couple would have no different standing from two good friends. my fiance is killed a week before we were scheduled to be married. The law would say, but she was never your spouse. You don't show up on our list here, the invitee list. Engaged people don't qualify, married people do. Again, what's your attitude about whether a marriage license should be the be-all and end-all of legal status? Some people would say, duh, that's really, really important. And getting married is quite different from simply having, you know, strong feelings towards somebody. Other people would say, no, it's the depth and the quality of the relationship that matters. I know unmarried couples that are a lot more faithful to each other and have a closer relationship than people who have a marriage license but are, you know, Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know. It's I'm just saying we're in the middle of this kind of firestorm in terms of figuring out, well, what counts here? How much should this law reflect other kinds of social values, and to what extent should it be based on some other criteria? Okay, why don't we move on here to our next topic, and I want to preface this next topic. Not only does it raise some rather delicate issues families and human life and so forth, but there are some technical issues I want to make sure we clearly understand before we plunge into this. The area of wrongful birth and wrongful life arises, the unique body of law here, arises from a situation where the defendant's negligence results in a human life. Speaking as one whose parents' negligence resulted in his life, I have a strong sympathy for that. I mean no disrespect by referring to this, but I want to distinguish this from a case in which the doctor's negligence results in injury to a child. So, for example, if the doctor doesn't properly read the fetal heart monitor or gives an overdose of some anesthetic used in the birth process, and a child suffers brain damage or a spinal cord injury or something else, is born in such a way that they suffer a lifelong disability, that is not a wrongful birth case. The question you have to ask is, did the doctor's negligence result in the birth of a child, or a physician's negligence result in the birth of a child? That's the question of the hour. If so, we have these unique problems. If not, it's not as though it's a walk in the park to figure out how much a child should be compensated because the doctor squeezed too hard on the forceps or did something else that caused injury to the child. There are problems with that, but they're the same problems we've already seen. What's unique about this, the reason it gets a section of its own, is that there are certain cases in which that's not the way the injury occurs. The injury occurs because, as in the next case, somebody negligently performs or negligently evaluates the outcome of a sterilization procedure, or somebody's contraceptive device fails, or there's some other problem in which people trying not to have children wind up having children. And so, again, the first turn you want to make in evaluating cases like this is to make sure you've got your facts straight and you're correctly understanding what took place. What is the doctor on trial for? It's particularly revealing when we get to the Harbison case, where a slightly different fact situation would generate a very different legal environment. Let's first do the Arizona Health Sciences Center case so we understand essentially what the law is on this point. Any volunteers here to take on? Go ahead. Okay. Okay, and just in brief summary, what's the defendant's answer to the claim, you negligently caused the birth of a child we had planned not to have? Right. Stop complaining. You're better off. And again, I don't want to over-personalize this, but my parents certainly weren't planning on having me, but they were quite happy when I was born. It's sort of been off and on ever since, but this is not an uncommon occurrence. And so the response of the defendant in saying, count your blessings, that's not a crazy answer. On the other hand, the plaintiff says it may not be crazy, but it's bad public policy. And so here again, this is why there are unique problems here that we have to address from the standpoint of, well, what should our tort law be in this area? So again, now that we've heard the defendant's answer, which is essentially you haven't been harmed. The plaintiff's answer is what? Okay, so it turns out just to start with, before we get the plaintiff's argument here, we recognize that kind of have there's door number one, door number two, door number three here that we can choose. The first option is essentially, actually the defendant doesn't say you get nothing. The defendant says, look, I'll pay for the cost of childbirth. I recognize I owe you something, but it's just the cost of childbirth. Missed, wages from work, the hospitalization expense, etc. We'll pay for that. But beyond that, once the child is born and if the child is healthy, you're on your own. Option two is what you refer to as the full damage rule, and in part, that is a way of saying, well, it's a recognition of the defendant's argument against door number three. So why don't we go to door number three and then we'll come back to door number two to figure out why the full damage rule would be preferable. Okay, what's door number three? Okay, we try to assess the pluses and minuses of this development. And I always need help from the accountants here. When you do debit and credit, the debits go on the left side, right? No, accountants in the house here. Okay, bookkeepers. Okay. And then we put the credits on the right side. So we just compare these two. What are the debits of having another kid? Let's see. We've got 2,400 Huggies, 18 pairs of Oshkosh Bagosh jeans, two scooters, one high chair. We make a list. you know, three visits to the juvenile detention facility, one prom dress, you know. We get the whole, as Zorba the Greek would say, the whole catastrophe. What do we put on the credit side? Yeah. Obviously, parenting, for all of its woes, has offsetting benefits. Those of us who are parents know that quite well. We wouldn't trade any of these. In fact, I have a very successful classmate. We actually did a trial team thing together. His name is Stephen Smith. He writes on religion issues, among others. And he's taught at Virginia and Notre Dame and Colorado and student places. I ran into him at a conference one time, and he and his wife had just had their eighth child, I think. And, you know, we were chatting about various things, and he said to me, you know, when each of my children was born, I look at them and I say, you know, there isn't anything I wouldn't sacrifice for this child. This child is just of infinite value. He says, now if I feel that way after they're born, then it would make sense that I should have as many children as I can. There's something wrong with that, but I haven't figured out what it is, he told me. Very smart guy, by the way. Now, if in fact that's the way people feel about it afterwards, at least to some extent, door number three says you do an assessment over here and then you do the offset over there, and whatever the difference is, let the chips fall where they may. Some births, in my parents' case, for example, they already had three children. In fact, my oldest brother is 4 years and 4 months older than I am, and there are two in between. You can imagine. Anyway, explains a lot, doesn't it? But still, my parents were quite ready. You know, having another kid was not a big deal. For some parents, where there are health hazards or they're not married or there's some other reason why it's just a disaster to have a child, then you would have a very different kind of ratio here. So door number three says, let's just, you know, calculate and figure it out. However, as I said before, there's an argument against that. What's the argument against it? The dissent says we shouldn't be doing this. Why not? Now, remember, we've been in the process of putting value. We look at the value of Mr. Rice. We look at the value of Nancy Feldman. What's so offensive about putting a value on Junior? Let's think about that for a second. It may explain a lot that I'm aware of the circumstances under which I was born. I might have been, you know, a normal, healthy human being, but for this terrible knowledge that my parents didn't plan for me. I don't think so. I don't think that's what's wrong with me. You're supposed to laugh a little bit here. Hell, work with me here, people. Okay. Now, is it that knowledge that my parents didn't plan for me that hurts? Or is it something different? There's actually something worse that's going on here if we play this game. Ms. Ma? They make a statement in court. Remember, if you're the defense attorney and you are taking the deposition of the parents who are the plaintiffs here. The plaintiffs have to prove to you how much they've been injured by the birth of this child. You issue a subpoena deuces tecum, bring something with you to the deposition, bring your kid with you. you know, and you kind of chuckle his little chin here, you know, and you know, make him make those goo-goo eyes that little babies do, and you say, now look at him. I know he's a lot of trouble, but aren't you glad you had him? The parents, if they want their lawsuit to survive, have to say, no. For their tort claim to survive, the parents have to badmouth their own kid. That's what the dissent says. What are we doing here? This is terrible public policy. We hope that parents will view this unplanned, unexpected development as a positive thing, not as something that we're still mad about. But this method says the parent's claim depends upon not getting over it, not seeing the benefit here. And the dissent says we should have none of it. Ms. Schmidt. Well, you could imagine a case in which, like the Terry Schiavo case, in which you could say, I wanted my spouse to be able to die, and instead you wrongfully kept her alive. You could have a sort of wrongful life. I don't want to go there just yet. I think the easier case that raises your same question is, what about Richard and Marianne Rodriguez that we're going to see in a little bit? The 600-pound pipe drops on Richard. Marianne comes and says, you dropped a 600-pound pipe on our marriage. I want some compensation for what I've lost. Now, the defense could say to Marianne, oh, I see, Marianne. It's not for rich or for poor in sickness or in health. It's only as long as the good times roll. And as soon as Richard isn't much fun anymore, you have your hand out wanting compensation. What kind of marriage is this anyway? Ooh. Is Marianne's request for compensation evil and wicked? Because she says, or for that matter, the parents that I represented who say my daughter's, you know, foot was horribly burned and we've had to take her to the hospital and, you know, she couldn't do this and we had all these, you know. Oh, so you're saying parenting's supposed to be fun all the time? Never any problems? Well, wait a minute. Once we go down this road of compensating people for suffering, is there some form of suffering that we say, no, but we can't compensate for that? I mean, maybe we should rethink what we're doing here. Are we encouraging people to malinger? Are we encouraging people to say, oh, poor me, when maybe society should say, yes, you've had these horribly, you know, disfiguring, before you had this potential career as a newscaster, and now you've been horribly disfigured, and you'll never be able to work in that industry again, and, you know, so forth and so on. But think of the inner truth you've discovered. Oh, yeah, thanks. I don't think that's a crazy response. Spiritually, theologically, I think there's actually a lot of truth. There's something very complex going on here. We don't have a very good handle on, is what I'm saying. Now, again, the tort system is coming in with its, you know, clunky boots here, stomping all over everything, into these delicate human relationships, and what do we do? How do we balance these things? Should we tell all people who've had personal, you know, injury that suffering ennobles? Suffering is a way to inner discovery? Should we Should we go this direction and say it's perfectly appropriate for parents to describe, as it is true, what a burden it's been to have this additional child? Should we say, no, we don't want to do that? Eesh, this is no fun. Yeah. I think the dilemma is for the personal injury lawyer. If you hire me because your child has been disfigured, horrible burn injury, is it my job as a personal injury lawyer to take that child, parade the child before the jury, and invite the jury to engage in pity, in effect, to say, oh man, that's the worst thing that ever happened. That kid's life is ruined. That's the way I can extract the most cash from these folks. I'm just in the cash business here. Or do I have a responsibility as a personal injury lawyer not to go there, to say, it's not all about the cash. You can get a big mountain of cash, and where will it get you? If the price of getting all that cash commitment to having your life ruined. Many years ago, in fact, you may have seen the Holly Caudill portrait. It's on the second floor or the third floor. She was a student here. She had been injured in a van rollover when she was 15 or 17, something like that. Went to college, went to law school. She got around by blowing into a tube that would move her wheelchair around. That was all. She couldn't move, anything else except her mouth, basically, and her eyes and so forth, but had no control over anything else. She had all kinds of internal problems that eventually took her life. She died just of internal complications about 4 or 5 years ago, I can't remember exactly when. But she graduated from law school, and she was working for the U.S. Attorney in San Diego. She used to go give motivational speeches to teenagers to say, in effect, I made it, so can you. Now, again, if you're representing Holly Caudill, spinal cord victim in an accident, how do you present that to the jury? Her life is over, it's ruined, she'll never have, On the one hand, I would want to tell the jury just what it's like to have a spinal cord injury and what, But again, it just raises the most profound questions about what you're doing as a plaintiff's lawyer. I'm not sure it's wrong. I'm not sure it's right. I'm standing up here conflicted. Now, that, ironically, makes the most effective advocacy. If I'm just a hard-bitten personal injury lawyer exploiting my clients, using them to get a huge contingency fee and then throwing them away like Kleenex, if that's the way I feel about my clients, I'm not going to make much money, I hope. To some extent, but I'll be the most effective advocate if the jury thinks, for one brief shining moment, I'm a decent human being, I actually care about this client, and I can convey to them something that makes them trust me, so that when I ask them for $1,400 gazillion, they'll give it to me. So in some sense, I have to be conflicted to be successful in this business. I can't be all one thing or the other. Maybe that's sort of the way life is. In any event, enough for today. We'll pick this up tomorrow.